My name's Peter Schillingsburg. I'm the director of the Center for Textual Scholarship. We are in the Center for Textual Scholarship at De Montfort University. We are here to discuss the role of print editions in the digital age, and it is a roundtable discussion which involves Nigel Wood and Gabriel Egan from Loughborough University, Shikanta Chaudhry and Abhijit Gupta from Jadavpur University, Paul Eggert from the University of New South Wales, and a collection of interested and interesting people who wish to discuss this topic. We might also, as we go along, discuss how the insights of textual criticism might be better presented to students and to critics at large, but that shall come up spontaneously, if indeed it comes up at all. We are interested in this subject, I think, because electronic scholarly editing has had such a large press recently, although in examples of what scholarly electronic editions can be, there are very few really impressive sites as yet. And print editions continue to be produced. In fact, various people sitting at this table are in the process of producing print editions. And the question is, for scholarly editions, what is the continued role? Why are they continuing to do print editions in an age when scholarly electronic editions seem such wonderful possibilities? And I'd like to begin. I gather that the contributions of various people will be more or less informal, and we'll begin with Gabriel Egan.
Thank you, Peter. Well, the question, Cetrus, the topic is, what's the continued role of print scholarly editions in the so-called digital age? And I suppose one way to come at that is to examine the economics of producing print editions. The market for books in general has changed substantially in the last 20 or 30 years. I think there were large questions about the sustainability of the market from the publisher's point of view. Talking to publishers about their long-term business plan, they all tend to get rather pale and shaky when they ask to discuss what they think the long-term market for scholarly books is. And my own experience of what is happening with digital editions lately is that, well, for example, I've just recently examined an MA thesis that manages to discuss 16th and 17th century representations of sexuality using entirely Igbo texts, not using any modern editions of those core works. There's a shift, with the availability of things like Igbo and Echo, which is online, seems to be a shift to unedited texts just because they're available. And it is hard to see just what added value, or to make the case for the added value that we've got into print editions, good critical print editions, in the past, when they served such a wide market. People would, you'd buy a good critical edition because it was the only thing you could, only way you could get an obscure text in a certain period. Now that's not true. We have to make a much greater case for the editing itself being the added value. And if we don't, it seems people will just go back to unedited text, or at least they'll go to the early printing they can get for free. I'm not at all sure I'm against them doing that. This thesis passed. I could see nothing wrong with it. There were certain things were introduced into the thesis because they were using unedited text. They were unaware, the reader, this MA student, was unaware of what I thought were obvious typos, and they simply reproduced them without comment. On the other hand, they looked at books that 5 or 10 years ago you'd have to make trips all around the world to look at. They used them intelligently. I couldn't help feeling this was a democratization. So I don't have an answer to the topic's question other than it is gravely in doubt, I think, the future. It seems to me like editors have to defend themselves rather more vigorously than they have in the past because, as I say, it is no longer the case that the only way to get this stuff is through a digital edition. You can just go to modern digitalizations of early printing. That's all I'd like to say for now, as it's introduced that economic element, I think.
Well, look, it's Paul Eggert speaking now. I think I could simply continue that on, and perhaps later I might want to challenge one or two of the things that you said. But the economic argument, I think, is a real one. And in some respects, I think you can say that that the question of the role of printed scholarly editions, or indeed of printed scholarly titles of any kind, is a subset of the larger question of the role and viability of the printed book, of the role of some of them in conducting a cultural debate, their role, their probably continuing role as in some ways superior, it's based on their superiority to alternative forms of communication and discussion such as blogs. That is to say, the time, the concentration of effort, the potential depth that a book, the potential depth of thought that a printed book typically brings to bear, I'm talking of scholarly books, typically brings to bear, by virtue of the fact that books require deadlines, they require proofs, they require a series of steps that happens to suit human capabilities. We bring ourselves up to the mark, so to speak, partly because of the technology of the printed book, and I think in terms of quality of thinking, that remains so. But there's one other thing too. Physically, the material book is hanging on as an object, as it's presently, in most cases, a better device than an e-reader is, but not in all settings and not for all books. Clearly, for linear text, in fact, Federico and I were discussing this at lunch, clearly for extended linear text, printed books still are an exceedingly good piece of technology. For a more fragmented text, e.g. dictionary entries, many forms of reference, many forms of reference book, it's dubious. The case, I think, has clearly shifted in some areas towards the superiority of electronic books. But I'd like to read you, or read into our official record here, a quotation from chapter one of a book. I'll just hold it up. It's called "The Book Is Dead." Now, this is a book called, the whole book is called "The Book Is Dead," and chapter one's called "The Book Is Dead," and I've received it. It's written by a man called, Stacey Kent, an Australian. I was sent notice of the fact that this chapter was available for free. It's clearly a form of advertising the book as a whole. So the electronic means of communication that brought this piece of these sheets of paper into my hand, I guess, can't be overlooked. But what I want to quote is this. Printed books have become more... And he's talking, I think it's a he, is talking about printed books as a whole here. And, in fact, he's getting kind of rather angry about the way in which the book has become a sort of device for communicating sort of unscholarly debates has become utterly commodified. He says, printed books have become more like television shows. The need for speed and instant gratification has resulted in the anti-book object that dominates today's book trade. Books are now designed to capitalise on particular moments, to leverage off other media assets, to profit from corporate synergies, to buy into the 5 minutes of fame demanded of modern celebrity culture, and to pander to the get-rich-quick schemes that pass for self-help. And books themselves reflect this cultural shift with shorter chapters, fewer words, splashier graphics, and absolutely no ideas. What's more, these books are now given only a few months to be successful before they are yanked off the shelves. You could probably mark the beginning of the end of the you could probably mark the beginning of the end for the book with the invention of the telegraph, at the moment when information began to move more quickly than goods. Since then, the book has found breathing more difficult. Follow its long, slow demise through to the concentration of global multimedia empires in the late 20th century, where it struggles on, choking for air. But to suggest that the book has run out of oxygen solely because of technological change is too determinist. He then goes on to argue, in fact, new technologies will save book culture. The distinguishing between book culture and the printed book. Computer-based communication, social networks, and newly deinstitutionalized creativity can play a role in reprivileging the idea of ideas. The essence of the book can be captured and distilled from its material form, he argues. The new technologies can form the basis for reinvigoration and reinvention of book culture. Rather than cling desperately to the old ways, we should embrace the opportunities presented by the new. And then he concludes, the object of the book is the problem. Well, let me just stop there. I've said enough for now, and I'll come back, and because there's clearly things you could say about that. You could also say that the object of the book is the opportunity for many forms of thinking, and that book culture, when it comes to the scholarly edition, although it is most definitely a problem for publishers to formulate a business case around, scholarly editions do not sell well, there's no doubt about that. Even the very biggest presses are not publishing more than 500 copies of a scholarly edition nowadays. As a result, they're expensive. As a result, mostly only libraries buy them. As a result, most users of scholarly editions have to borrow them from their institutional libraries. So there are a series of questions which push towards a future of the electronic edition, for the electronic edition, based around distribution. But what we have to remember is the scholarly edition is a fiendishly good and highly developed piece of technology in its capacity to present information in a highly economic form. That is the textual apparatus. Which gives an epitome of the work's development over time through a series of versions, the explanatory notation, which locate many problematic areas of the text, as the editor is aware of, within contexts of whether biographical, historical, social, and then of course the accompanying essays, textual, biographical, historical, which surround the text, so that the scholarly edition, in the words of Craig Munro, my editor at the University of Queensland Press, who sat on the on the editorial board of the Academy Editions of Australian Literature series for some years, he finally said to me, "I've realised what a scholarly edition is." And he's thinking from the point of view of a publisher. He said, "It's two books in one. It's a book about a book, and you get both." So let me stop there.
Shrikanth Choudhury, Jadavpur University. I won't actually at this point of the discussion sort of make the points about electronic editions and print editions, which I sort of brought along in the squiggle form. We're probably sort of gradually working our way into the discussion. I think we haven't got there yet. But some other more basic points have come up, which I think need to be tackled. And particularly, I'd like to just sort of take up one or two of the things that Gabriel said, which was concerned with the general question of the greater availability of electronic editions, online editions, as opposed to print editions. Now, this is where, you know, I think a point does need to be made, that from other parts of the world, the situation can seem radically different, especially from that where I come from and where my colleague Abhijit comes from, because what we are finding, oddly enough, is that the technology of online transmission has not brought about the democratization of knowledge, which in fact one would have expected, simply because of the economic barriers in place. I come from what is by no means one of the most impoverished of the countries of the sort of what we no longer call the third world, but there is no university in my country which could even remotely begin to consider putting up the money to subscribe to Ebo. Whereas now, of course, with the coming of Ebo, this is a tool which is now freely available in most universities or other institutional sites in the West. So what we are finding, in fact, that a greater gulf by way of accessibility has opened up between scholars and students in one of the better endowed knowledge centers of the world and those elsewhere, that they can now much more easily access a greater range of resources than we do, and the gulf is greater than it was in the days of print. when the relatively limited number of print editions, however expensive, could be purchased, if not by one university, then by another, and could be there some kind of sharing of resources. So this, in fact, is a big problem, which, of course, even I quite realize that within the Western world, the problem of what electronic editions and databases and e-journals cost has become a major problem, and there are various movements against it and various measures which are now beginning, for instance, digitizing texts in various major academic libraries. The Bodleian has already struck a deal, I think, with Google. British Library is talking about it. This may radically change the scene, and I hope it does. But the economic factor is as important as the purely technological factor in gauging our access to this material. So I think I'll stop now. I mean, I do have some things I'd like to say about, sort of electronic editions vis-a-vis print editions. But maybe that'll come in better if we have a second round of presentations.
Okay. I'm Abhijit Gupta from Jadavpur University. Again, two responses to two of the points which have been made so far, and I think which are useful starting points for us too. And one is, of course, the getting hold of the economic part of the argument, and which, when Gabriel was making the points, I was reminded of this, of Robert Danton as early as 1999, making this point about a pyramidal electronic monograph. This essay called New Age of the Book in the New York Review of Books, he said that the academic monograph was an endangered species because even award-winning ones did not sell and could not be sold. And the cost of producing them, and indeed the cost of buying them, was so prohibitive. And not just academic monographs, if you think of academic journals, for instance, scientific journals especially, which cost an arm and a leg. Whether there was whether some kind of a model, and whether this was an early sort of electronic archive that he was talking about, of a monograph which would be arranged in a kind of pyramidal structure, where you'd have the argument, the basic argument at the top, and then the chapters proceeding, which could be read both vertically and horizontally, so that all the 150 letters that you could not put in the footnotes could be sort of packed into one tier, and then you could have another where the readers responded in a sort of a more interactive atmosphere. And I suspect that was a model which he suggested, but that was never really seriously taken up, because the whole imperative of publishing printed books as part of our academic requirements and academic the pursuit still is very much compelling. It seems to me that the decreasing size of the book militates more and more against scholarly editions. I mean, you're telling the story about how certain part of the apparatus have to be left out of a printed book. I mean, where do you put in all that? I mean, and what does it do to the costs of a book, of producing a book? And then those costs are transferred to the buyer. I mean, if not the individual buyer, at least to the library or the department or whoever has to buy them, and you have just less and less money to go about. The other point which Professor Chaudhary raised, and I think is a very valid point, especially given the context, given our localities, is that since we cannot subscribe to EBO, or since students who we teach will not in the near future be in a position to subscribe to EBO, we have to do with access to Google Books or even Project Gutenberg. So, that kind of gulf which is being caused, and, if you've been following this debate between Paul DeGuid and Patrick Leary on Google Books, how one edition of Tristram Shandy was so badly scanned by Google that it was supposed to be a scholarly edition, no sense could be made of it. So if you, depending on that kind of random or accidental access, and then again the question of the algorithm which generates the searches, what comes up first? Is that the most preferable of the editions? What sort of calculation goes into that? That's really we know very little about. So I'll stop here, and if these points.
I suppose we look for print to supply us with decisions. Decisions that are frozen in time and therefore are answerable. And I think that there is a room for that. I think there's also vestigial longing for that among from readers, that there is a cogency about having a deadline, and gathering, with an eye to posterity, gathering up your thoughts and your efforts towards a deadline. It doesn't stop, of course, there being notes and queries that come afterwards that lead to other impressions, other editions thereafter. The trouble about electronic text is that it just replaces itself. We were talking just before the podcast started about Wikipedia. And I may be able to refer to a Wikipedia entry on Stanley Fish or W.W. Gregg, by the time we all now go after this meeting to actually consult, it may have changed completely. There's been no sign that it has, there's been no announcement that it has, but there's a nominalism about our reference to its existence, which is wonderfully flexible, it's manipulable, it's instantaneous. But there is a problem of reference. There's a problem, maybe, of whether we turn to a scholarly edition for information or decisions that are made of the information or from the information that we've got. It's what Lyotard thought was the constituting virtue or otherwise of postmodernism, the fact that we live in an information age. What we're lacking is the ability to make the most of that or to stand up for the philosophical priorities to make something of that information. It is so fertile, our ability to lay hold of a simple fact, that sometimes our understanding of how that fact has been selected for us, either by Google, by which text has been scanned in and gone into the Ebo, that is now relegated to a subsidiary question, a corollary. Well, if we're going to be philosophical about it, it ought to rank up there with every other question that we're asking. So the ease of access is, of course, a kind of democratization, but what is the basis for its cogency as a philosophical act, or an act of decision? That is the problem that I think we face. The possible inaccuracy of the information we get is also something that needs to be touched upon. The last thing is coverage. Oxford University Press in 2006 did a survey of how far would a digital edition reach. In other words, how many people, literate people across the world, could actually read a digital edition if that was the principal mode of dissemination? Well, 82% could receive it if they paid the license fee, the software, and they had the software in America. And we go down to 75% in Australia and Britain, roughly the same, 6% in Nigeria. So where are we speaking to when we think about purely electronic, principally electronic means of dissemination? And I think there is a kind of blindness there about pushing the electronic version too fast and too hard.
Could I put 2 cents worth in and also invite everyone who wants to make a comment, and then perhaps open it to more serious responses around? And what I would like to say, a couple of things that I would like to say, is that the topic is specifically scholarly editions as opposed to just generally print editions. And so access to text is only one aspect of the issue. So indeed, if Ebo or other forms of reproduction make it possible for more libraries and therefore more people, either through the means of computer access or even we can include microfilm in this, or facsimile reprints such that people would be able to see the raw material of the original text, that is one aspect that is extremely important. In a scholarly edition, in any scholarly edition, that raw text has two things done to it, one of which has been mentioned and one not. The thing that has been mentioned is that it is associated with a book about it, about its various forms, about its composition, about how it relates to other things, and quite frequently also with the kind of supplying in essays or in annotations the things that went without saying originally, but for people coming to these very same texts in a different time, in a different place, no longer go without saying. And if you care at all about the historical meanings of texts or access to historical meanings of texts, as opposed to simply using a text as a springboard for whatever it is that we can make of it now, then these aspects of the scholarly edition are added value that will never be in Ebo or any other facsimile, as important as those are. But in print scholarly editions, mostly the text is transcribed and emended. so that the sense of age, the sense of originality is always done away with in favor of something that is a textual representation of what should have been or what ought to be, and that is a serious problem. If we think of our knowledge of text as going back somehow or another to the original, so that even with a scholarly edition, you want to ask, oh, where did that information come from? And if a university press, by having the word university in its name, if an editor, by having the word professor in front of him, or by any other means, can gain credibility for the accuracy or viability of the product that is the print scholarly edition, that's to the good, but doesn't actually answer the question, where did this come from and is it accurate? Whereas a photograph of a text in Ebo or Google Books has a kind of built-in mechanical validation of itself, even though it lacks the added value of the scholarly input. So those are the two things that I wanted to focus attention on, and to say that one of the things in electronic editions is that by having an image as the base rather than having the scholarly edited text as the base, we have a gain. But what we've lost in projects like Ebo and Google Books is the scholarly added value, and goodness knows, in Project Gutenberg, we never had anything.
Can I just connect two points that were made there? Paul asserted that the book is really good as a technology for carrying the thing you're talking about. And my feeling is it's a terrible technology for carrying the knowledge you're talking about. If I'm holding an edition of a Shakespeare play, the way to find out what the various underlying, what the various early printings were and what readings they had is this collation at the bottom of the page, which almost all readers don't know how to use, including the ones in universities. Almost all don't know what that strange collection of sigla actually amounts to. And even those that do will have to do something very awkward, which is, say it says at the bottom of the page that this reading used in the edition came from Hanmer. You need to know who Hanmer is, which means turning first of all to the front of the book to find where the list of abbreviations is kept in the book. Starts page 390, then going to that page. There's a double jump, and then finding within sometimes several lists of all the abbreviations and references who Hanmer was and what Hanmer did. That to me is an exceedingly poor solution to the problem of presenting to the reader the effort of the editor in tracking down what would be perhaps the best reading to use in this line. And I'm always surprised when users of books claim they find this straightforward and easy. I find it a terrible technology. And then that's the best we've done after several hundred years of refining.
I wasn't claiming it's the best. What I was claiming is that it is extremely economic. We're talking about a technology in which it is prohibitively expensive to produce facsimiles of every version of the work, as well as the study of those versions finally expressed in a reading text with apparatus. But let me give you an example, because I think personally I'm in a sort of halfway house. I'm both a digital skeptic and an opportunist, contradictorily most of the time. At the moment, I've just designed a sort of a halfway house edition, which is a series of short stories by an Australian short story writer of the 1890s, Henry Lawson, and the collection, the short stories were originally published in newspapers and then were clipped from the newspapers by Angus and Robertson, a publisher in Sydney, that wanted to publish a number of them in a collection called While the Billy Boils. So they were clipped, the individual cuttings were put onto wire to large sheets of heavy paper stock to give him the equivalent of galley proofs to write corrections and expansions or deletions, whatever, down both sides. for various reasons that I won't go into now, we've decided to privilege the newspaper versions rather than the version in the collection of 1896, which has been in fact endlessly reprinted. So the earlier Lawson that we're privileging, then in a scholarly edition, is going to require at foot of page, preferably because it's easier to work with a foot of page apparatus than one at the end of the volume, as clear a way forward as we can to notate the differences between the newspaper version and the 1896 version. Now, because we've got these clippings, these marked up clippings, and because it's very, it's reasonably easy to differentiate between Lawson's corrections and those of his editor and those of a third person who went over the top, in a series of steps that were sometimes recursive, you get to exactly the stage you're talking about, Gabriel. Well, I've played around with the apparatus endlessly on this to try and get it as clear as possible. Apparatus that is successful is actually a continuous check on the textual analysis of the history. Any sort of editor who's done a good deal of this realises that the apparatus gets out of hand and starts to do all sorts of odd things if you've got your historical analysis wrong. Most readers don't realise that. Once the textual apparatus is actually working, it's actually a check on a textual argument. A critical edition in print form is an immensely cross-referential beast. So I think that needs to be borne in mind. But my point for this anecdote is that fortunately, the State Library of New South Wales agreed to do beautiful, huge TIFF files of these manuscripts. There's a couple of hundred pages which they've supplied me with, and they're also going to mount them on their website and will allow me to mount them on my center's website. So the reader of the scholarly edition will have beautiful digital images of these fairly complex documents in front of them in colour at the same time as they've got a textual apparatus and a text. Now, perhaps this is an experiment, obviously. Perhaps users will want to go straight to the document on screen after they've looked perhaps at our text. Then they want to see what Lawson's done on both sides of the clipping that our text is representing. But of course, often they're not there, and this is so true of so many manuscripts. Often the unskilled reader is just not going to be able to figure out what the series of steps were or who the parties were that were making these changes. The textual apparatus will act as a sort of an epitome of a history. It will summarise and help the reader with something that's on screen. So I offer that as a sort of halfway house. It's certainly not an electronic edition, but it's an electronically assisted, enhanced edition. It will be.
Are we sort of going round again? A couple
anybody?
Of points I'd like to
go ahead.
Where Gabriel left off, as it were, by his saying that he thought the standard layout of the critical edition was a very bad piece of technology. Of course, in that case, a fair question is to ask that what better would an electronic edition provide? And in fact, that's the question I have been sort of asking myself in the inadequate homework I sort of put in for this afternoon. And in fact, I looked for this purpose at three kinds of print scholarly editions, taking as a kind of midway point something which is very familiar, which is used by the Board of Art students, with the standard Arden, Oxford, and New Cambridge Shakespeare, which is probably the most familiar layout of a critical edition for any of us. And it has also the advantage that all the material that goes into it has, it were, undergone a kind of process of filtration of about 300 years. So it's not simply what an individual editor is doing to the raw text. And as against that, on the one side, I considered what is within my knowledge is the edition which has to present the most complicated sort of set of textual variations that are genetically presented, which is Hans Gabler's edition of Ulysses. I mean, and presented synoptically, as it were, in the words of the editors themselves, in a single page, at a single glance. And on the other hand, and this is the sort of wildcard factor that I introduced, I considered some things which in a totally different context I've been looking at recently, which are something seldom brought into a discussion of this sort. Some 16th century folio editions of the variorum editions of the works of Virgil. Actually, think anybody looking at, you know, electronic editions which they want to put on site, on screen, should look at these with the resources of the very oldest, or almost the oldest phase of letterpress printing. They are arranging a remarkable number of components on a single page. So, I'm sure if you know these things, there's the actual line, there's the original text in the middle, surrounded by various commentaries, very intricately organized, and sometimes with woodcuts, with summaries, with incidental comments, like the argumentum put at the start of each. It's really extremely complicated, and it does manage to present a great deal of varied information on a single page. That I ordered a copy which I from the Bodleian Library, which I thought I'd be able to bring and show you today, except that when the envelope arrived this morning, I found that although it had my name on the outside, in fact contained a different copy ordered by somebody else, some completely different material. Yeah. So I have to sort that one out. But anyway, to tell you what I was saying. So I asked myself, what are these editions doing, which we can, as therefore, also ask of the electronic edition, and then see whether the electronic edition would do it better. And on the whole, I think electronic edition would do it better. See, for instance, the variant readings, especially if there is sort of a whole sort of layer upon layer of variant readings, and you want to present them as if sort of genetically, as in the Ulysses, the Gobbler's Ulysses edition. Mm. Now, that amazingly complex, painstaking system of multiple brackets, that does really need a very great deal of working out. Now, I don't know how many people do get the hang of it, even after looking at it for months and years. Whereas this, with an electronic equivalent, you could really present it on the screen in such a way that, you know, you can sort of, with clicks of the mouse, you could open up as much of the history of the text and the various layers of revision as you needed, see. Or if you wanted to look at whole sort of larger blocks of text together, open up multiple windows on a single screen. The second point in analyzing these variants and trying to arrive at some kind of final text. One of the most exciting experiences of my life was when I saw Peter Robinson's Chaucer program and how that could take 50 or 60 different manuscript readings, crunch them and come up with this sort of vast radial diagram, placing them in some kind of relationship to each other. Now, whether you want to let the computer sort of, as it were, make up your mind for you, that's a different matter. But at least it is possible to, as it were, sort of extend the reach of schematics much further with the electronic resource and the sheer extent of sort of text crunching that allows than would be possible with the conventional printed edition, which is almost by its nature restricted to the sort of straight line, classic Lachmanian kind of schematics, as it were. And this is where it's the sort of last point I'd like to make, which really takes up something that you said, Nigel, about the philosophy underlying the printed edition and how it insists that we take a decision. Now, I would like to suggest that maybe, given the way very large quantities of textual information and parallel lines of textual information as a sort of variant texts, the same work, can be organized electronically, whether one cannot come up with a kind of alternative philosophy, as it were, which may, as I suggest it is, be sort of truer to the way texts grow and develop and ramify, which is to create a different mindset where you do not so much feel the need to choose one particular text. I'll be finding it increasingly difficult to choose one particular version out of many alternative ones. Mm. We may not always agree with this kind of state of aporia that results. I personally, for instance, don't think that there's any need to keep the quarto and the folio texts of Lear completely separated. But still, we are increasingly feeling the need for this kind of for keeping multiple texts, variant texts of the same work in view at the same time. Mm. And this is itself a kind of decision, I think. It is a different way of looking at the cluster of texts that surrounds the upper work. And this is certainly something which only electronic resources will enable us to attain to. I don't think the print medium can attain to it. But we may come to think of it as a truer way of looking at the phenomenon, you know, of the development of, I don't know what to use the word development in any evolutionary sense, but let us say the ramification, the change, the extension of a text to its various versions.
Okay. I mean, I appreciate that, and I appreciate also that for the skilled peruser of a digital edition, you get a far better sense of what you really mean by the existence of the prelude, the existence of a particular King Lear actually might be. And we're talking about several moments, we're not talking about one moment. So the philosophy of decision making is therefore slightly laid aside, isn't it? Because what we really mean, what we want perhaps when we mention King Lear, is a sense of how there has been a King Lear that's existed as a mobile sense of decisions made by many people, not just Shakespeare, theatre company, compositors and so on. So yeah, I think the digital editions, electronic capture of that information will probably represent that better. There is an instance, it just occurred to me, that I just finished editing She Stoops to Conquer by Goldsmith, and there is extant, freed, we'd like to think, of any kind of censorship intervention in the Lapith manuscripts of the Huntington, some radically different readings, more racy, certainly more sort of drama a clay references, which are not normally there in the more polite version that was staged at Drury Lane. But you could argue that Goldsmith would, if he had the opportunity to, have reproduced those, because it's a fair copy, it looks as though this is feeding in. Now, but my decision, more often than not, was not to adopt the Larpent edition, for reasons I don't want to detain you with. But I would much rather that on, you know, the one coup day, looking at a page, my 60-40 decision to reproduce the reading I had, the reader was more often than not obliged to look at the qualifications on my eventual choice. Mm. And that was better sort of encapsulated in the page. To some extent, that's what I meant by kind of decisiveness about it. I feel freer to make a bolder choice of what goes on that, and with all the judgments, you know, we're talking about my judgment now. Mm. Other people may have different judgments on that. But if the reader was, more often than not, obliged also to look at my working, almost at the same time, rather than a serial choice to cross-refer, no matter how nicely imaginative the blue or red sort of hyperlink sort of reference was, there would still be an element of serial decision-making as to whether that would take place. And I still think there's some advantage of, no matter how laborious it would be to recapture what the digital edition would do, of that kind of decision making.
So now, there was just one point which is not exactly relevant to this, but I'm being a bit of a heckler here. And look, so far, what we have been discussing, I mean, the Chaucers and so on, for these were all, we have access to the manuscripts, to the manuscript form in which they were produced. So, there with the manuscript, you have the galley proofs and so on and forth. But what of when we start editing modern, let's say the work of Edward Said, for instance, electronically produced, which have one electronic existence in one country, and one in America and one in Palestine. Where are the traces and the erasers of such textual changes? How do we measure that? Do we design electronic tools which will be able to measure the changes, if they are at all detectable? I mean, are we looking at track changes, for instance, of articles for which variant textualities may even be a deliberate strategy? I mean, I refer to Said because he used different versions of his, and he wanted different versions of his work to appear in different countries. Now, if a work has its origin in the electronic form, it's transmitted through emails and so on and forth, through PDF files, how do we measure the changes, the textual changes that those texts undergo? Should we not be keeping those possibilities or those challenges in mind as well when we are developing a kind of grand unified theory for what we want electronic relations to do?
Just on that particular point, thinking about how you might do it technically with products like, say, the defunct Arden Shakespeare, you would actually be committing under the American Millennium Act, a crime, if you did the kind of detective work necessary to work out what was the underlying text, or was its structure. You'd have to actually crack its digital rights management to see the text. Your point was about Saeed's own copies. I'm just thinking about the published copy.
Mm-hmm.
You couldn't actually break it down without committing a crime, as far as I can tell, because it is protected. It doesn't present its underlying text to you. It's not something simply marked up. It's binary and it's protected. So that's a very interesting question. You'd need hackers to actually commit crimes to do the kind of bibliography, bibliographical study of electronic texts that are actually out there and you can purchase, which is extraordinary in the position to be in. But I just want to come back to something you said, Sukanta, about the 300 years of filtering. If the Oxford and Arden and Cambridge Shakespeare's feel like that, but actually, I'm looking at them very closely, I don't think they are filtered, in so much as there isn't an accumulation of knowledge. There's a remarkable returning to first principles. I've been looking through, one by one, the Arden first series from 1899 to 1910, and amazingly, Mr. Stratford Avon, to the Shakespeare Institute, to do this. In most cases, I had to cut the pages of the introductions to actually read. These things had lain there 100 years, extraordinarily, in a specialist research library, unread. What I found was remarkably fresh, actually, the stuff. The ideas were ones that are, in many cases, current ideas that have been forgotten for most of the 20th century. Looking at the very latest Arden Shakespeare, for example, it's extraordinary the choices that editors are now making. Polonius says to Laertes, never a borrower or a lender, boy. And I'm waiting for the word B at the end of that line. And it's not there. The latest Arden Shakespeare hasn't got that. Or when Hamlet chooses not to kill Claudius, because killing him when he's a prayer would be base and silly. That's what the current Arden edition says, not higher in salary. Looking at how the choices get made, it seems to me much more capricious, not in the sense that these people aren't being reckless. It's they're allowing their particular choices that make sense to them and are coherent within that one body of work to dominate, rather than saying, well, I'm in an Arden tradition, so I need to actually follow Arden rules. The editors are remarkably free, in fact, to make their own decisions and overturn their predecessors' decisions.
Yeah, I agree with you there. All I meant was that it's not as though the editor is coming to a text sort of for the first time or almost for the first time, but he's in most cases making his choice, which I agree with you, if we can be highly capricious, out of a range of possibilities which have almost been exhausted. And if occasionally he does come up with a completely new choice which nobody ever thought out before, well, sometimes you get the sense that he's done it in order to just to do something new, to create a novelty. But in any case, it's more rare. I mean, somebody editing a Shakespeare text is essentially feeling much more as if it's sort of cramped in, weighed down, use or letter, if you will. That he must have to clear a little space for himself to this great mass of, the rubble of the previous editions, as it were. And it isn't completely sort of, the rubble hasn't quite disintegrated out of the chunks of it. I suppose that's what I meant, really. I mean,
One of the real selling points, I started to say one of the real advantages, but it depends on what your point of view as to whether this is an advantage or not, but one of the selling points for print scholarly editions, whether they have footnotes at the bottom of the page or whether they are clear text or whether they have their apparatus all at the end or even embedded in the text. The selling point for the print edition is that it gives you access to the work as an aesthetic object. And particularly those clear text editions, that was their main business. The reason to edit these things are they're great works of art. They are great works of art because they address the human being and his form of existence in the way that he is, and the removal of error is just one thing. The other is to acknowledge either the value or the silliness of revisions or of censorship. So that the idea is to give readers who are not really interested in the history of this thing. They don't actually want to see multiple copies on the screen at once. They want a copy to read that they can engage with as a human document, as a human being, not as a textual scholar. Now, it seems to me that somewhere along the line, a failure has taken place by putting it the way I just put it, because as a human document, or as a human document that has history of revisions and the interference of other agents other than the author, and in fact, one wonders sometimes whether it was a good thing to let the author have his way, that some authors need, in fact, to be interfered with because of what? Where is the value that we are putting on the product of the editorial process? Is it simply historical? Let's just get the record straight. Let's put all of the information out there in an orderly way, possibly also an economic way, so that who can use it? Because Gabriel points out, a lot of people don't. So what is it that we actually want as editors to give to the world? Is it a text that they can read and engage with? Is it supposed to be the best text that they can engage with? Or is it a text that they can understand historically? And is there a way to engage in a text without engaging with its variant forms? I've argued that our way of understanding a written text is to, as the text goes along, we build up an expectation of what that text is going to say, and the difference between what we expected and what we got is actually where our sense of the meaning comes. And so I've been able to argue that if there is a historically variant text, the difference between that text and this text is not necessarily the difference between an error and a correct. It is a difference from which the tension between gives me a better understanding of this human document, which any one text is not going to give us. So, although I've written a book on the advantages of electronic editions, I'm actually thinking that one of the reasons to continue print scholarly editions is to address the ways in which textual criticism and we as textual critics can give to our students and to our fellow colleagues texts that they can engage with some kind of confidence, and which is closely associated with the information, not all of it necessarily, but perhaps arranged in such a way that the salient points of difference are available to them. And on top of that, I would like to say that I, in arguing the arguments of the book From Gutenberg to Google, suggesting that electronic editions would be much better than print editions, right in the middle of sort of wrapping that project up, I was offered the opportunity of continuing the Thackeray edition in print as opposed to electronic. I said, well, what about an electronic, or not interested in electronic edition? This is a publisher who is saying, no, we want a print edition, scholarly edition of Thackeray. And I had come to the point where I thought, no, it's not time for a print edition anymore. We need an electronic one. And then I got to thinking about it with the help of Paul Eckert and others with whom I sought advice, and hit upon several things. Number one, I actually had a publisher who was willing to do this. It would be a shame not to take advantage of this publisher. Number two, the electronic edition that I would like to produce of Thackeray, the one that I had just sort of imagined in From Gutenberg to Google, was not in fact possible yet. So that there would be not only the business of editing the text and producing it, but also of developing the medium for presenting it. And thirdly, if I did the print edition, I know it's going to be here for 350 years. And if I do the electronic edition, I don't know that it's going to be here for 350 years. Mm-hmm. Now, should I or should I not do this print scholarly edition? And I'm trying to do it. That's the decision.
Mm. It's a tough one. It depends whether you want posterity to look on your efforts with kindness for a long time. I suppose there's also
that. Well, they don't. No, posterity sure never don't. Has.
No, no, no. Well, rid yourself of that scruple then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Yes, of course.
Did you check what makes you sure it'll be around in 10 to 50 years' time if you do it in print?
Well, because I think that if the publisher prints, let us say, 180 copies and spreads them into 180 libraries, because individuals aren't going to buy this, it's not likely that all 180 libraries will disappear. But even then, I'm not sure that any work that I do ought to last for 350 years. I've had books that were printed on acid-free paper guaranteed to last for 350 years, and while the paper will last that long, I'm not actually sure that the ideas on the paper should last that long. That's quite true.
I mean, what we're implicitly talking about as well is the behavior of readers, aren't we? Because that's, at some level, is going to affect the kind of intentions we bring to bear or use value of the labor we put into the editions. You know, I mean, I think that book culture is a really important part of our lives.
Mm. Yeah. I thought that was fascinating and kind of opens it out, I think, in interesting ways to the second tier hecklers. Not that other contributions haven't, but you know, the thought of what it's all for and who you're producing this stuff for. Is it for the scholar? And if it's for the scholar, then the argument, it seems, from what I've heard so far, can go either way. You know what I mean? It could go towards the printed edition or the electronic edition. Or it's for some other purpose. And then we're into the issue of talking about what those other purposes are. Mm. And insofar as, you know, the default position in literary studies is not actually, I don't think, the kind of humanism that you just kind of talked about, but more as kind of historicism, I think, in fact, then those two purposes do coincide. But insofar as that human dimension that you're talking about is, you know, I don't know, still current or on its way back, or I don't know, then perhaps becomes more of an issue.
Well, I think it is current even among editors, because if you look at what authors or what works are being given the scholarly editorial treatment, almost always, but not always, the defense for having chosen this particular work to put, or this particular author to put these kinds of resources into, has to do with the value of the thing that was written. Now, if you're talking about, say, one of these newspaper projects, like the New Zealand newspaper project that was just launched recently, or for that matter, like the Observer and Guardian newspaper project that is coming up, for which you can subscribe, you'll have to pay money. You're going to be able to subscribe to the original newspapers all over again. It basically is just an image with a transcription that is searchable, but when I say it's just, I realize what a tremendous job that is. Mm-hmm. What a tremendous step forward it is to be able to go back and look at and read the newspapers of a country for a whole extended period. And that stands in some ways as a far more valuable project than a scholarly edition of Volkmar or the Mountain Men by William Gilmore Sims. A volume which is that thick, that's about an inch and a half thick, that contains a novel by a South Carolina writer that had previously been published only once. It's incredible how much resources went into that thing. And the defense of it was not that Volkmar was a great book. The defense of it was that William Gilmore Sims was South Carolina's best writer. But somewhere the word best or the word value or the word purpose or the word use comes in. And in fact, if we take the user's point of view a little bit more, because a lot of the tradition of scholarly editing and the design of scholarly editions, both in print and in electronic form, came from analyzing what it was that the editors thought they wanted to do, not by analyzing what we thought the reader needed or wanted to do. And certainly there have been very few studies of how readers read scholarly editions. But maybe there should be.
And that's the same for electronic edition as well, so far, isn't it? Mm. It's the editor's intention which decides how the text will be searchable and how and what sort of option will be given and what sort of layout you will have. I mean, it's different for things like e-book, which is just material. But when it comes to the scholarly edition, then it's not really readers dependent. It's more of the editors, if they're still controlling how.
I agree, Kakko, and I think that so far most electronic editions, at least those that have managed to get somewhere near completion, have essentially reproduced the paradigm of the printed book. Which is not surprising given what the printed book itself was doing in the 15th century, reproducing the paradigm of scribally produced manuscripts. But the scholarly edition, I think, will change in the electronic environment at the point at which the editor is prepared to relinquish that kind of control. At the same time, referring back to what you said, Nigel, about the importance of being prepared to risk your version of what the scholarly edited text ought to read, or what kind of privilege you ought to give to one version over another, or one series of intentions, or one series of inscriptions over another series. That act of decision making is not incompatible with electronic an electronic scholarly edition. But it's to date, you could say that electronic editions have only done what the printed book can do anyway. That is to say, printed books can be. We can have any number of facsimile editions. But we can, there is no problem there. We can have as many essays as you like in printed books. When we reach 800 pages or whatever it is the publisher dictates, we simply have another one. So the electronic scholarly edition has to do more than the printed book. It has to be a lot more compelling than the printed book before it will actually take off.
Aren't they? Surely. Before the OED was available electronically, you could only search by the word to find the meaning. Suddenly the whole world transforms. You can search knowing the meaning and not knowing the word.
Sorry, I meant to say the electronic scholarly edition is only going to be... I don't mean electronic books in general. I don't mean electronic text in general either. No, I mean the electronic scholarly edition. Earlier I said the problem, the crossover point is really the linear text as against electronic text in general, which in encyclopedias, dictionaries and other reference books is I think most people are using electronic delivery as a default position now. But with the electronic scholarly edition, I think it's a different matter. It has to do more than what the printed book has been able to do. And will only become compelling when it can.
May I just refer here to a remark by Roger Chartier, which I think has never been given the importance it deserves. Reminded of it by what you just said about the printed book continuing what the manuscript is doing. I forget where he writes this, but he says that what he regards as the two most decisive moments of change in the history of the written word, the two he cites, neither of them, the change from the manuscript to the printed book, but one is the change from the volume into the codex, and the other is from the written word as inscribed on paper or some such surface to the electronic text. I mean, in both these cases, you're getting the kind of formal, absolutely fundamental formal change that, in fact, you're not getting by a shift from manuscript to print. And, in fact, that shift, as we all know, was a very long-drawn one with a lot of movement in the reverse direction. Over 200 or 250 years, if not more. But with the volume into codex change, you are really getting an absolutely different way of organizing and handling a text And electronic text gives you that opportunity again to deal with a sort of different medium in spatial terms.
It is unbound in a way that even the Codex of the Volumen was bound in a way that the boundaries between texts that the pre-electronic age was something which was absolute, but now those boundaries have dissolved. Now, what do we do with these? Do we need new cognitive maps to make sense of the way in which textual boundaries have dissolved? Yes. And indeed, the boundaries between the maker of the text and the producer of the text in an electronic environment. How do we make sense of that when we are editing?
I think it's a different kind of reading, isn't it? I mean, it is very hard to get students who are relatively new to reading in a sustained sense to be rebellious, to actually make over the text to themselves in some ways. Digital editions cry out for a rebellious reader, an opinionated reader, aren't they? Because the thing is, you're by the linkage, you're supplying them with a lot more information from which they are expected to make a decision. Mm-hmm. Now that doesn't come, that liberation doesn't come naturally, I think, to a reader, or a peruser of pixels on the screen. I think it's something that has to be more embedded in the culture, more expected of the culture. And it might happen very quickly. I'm not saying that it is simply going into cul-de-sac. I'm not saying that. But at the moment, there's a kind of still vestigial problem about leaving book culture behind. Problem or book culture is, in fact, far more deeply within our souls than we thought. There's a Stephen Polyakov season of films on BBC at the moment, and there was one on Sunday night called Friends and Crocodiles. And there is a guru figure in that called, I think it's Paul Reynolds, who's given lots of money to spend 6 months in a room, set in 1984, to think up what the next new direction should be. And the whole of the assembled, no partitions on offices, office space, everybody is all open and free, even though they're terribly hierarchical, really. They all assemble to hear Paul Reynolds pronounce on what the future will hold. And they're very disappointed to find he has no dossier of papers in front of him. And he says, I've just got one word for you, and that's bookshops. I was scandalized that 6 months, bookshops are maybe serving some coffee. And everybody's scandalized. He gets the sack. He's laughed out of the room. Now, of course, the irony of that came out in 2006. The irony is that the book trade on a certain controlled level is holding steady. I mean, the independent bookshops are all going down the hill, I know that. But on the controlled sector are doing particularly well. What is it? Why do we constantly surrender ourselves and prefer to go to see a theatrical performance as opposed to even Laurence Olivier's Henry V? I mean, surely, if it was a purely incremental evolutionary scale, even those rudimentary 1946 and 1943 versions of cinematic effect would have outdistanced what we see even nowadays in Stratford. But we don't. So there's something about the ritualized way we encounter the word that is proving very hard to eradicate. And that might be quite interesting to
even
deal
if that's
with.
True, I'll do a footnote.
What's wrong with that?
Well, also, I wanted to turn to it, because I'm glad we came back to the economics, because Peter said he's sure that in 350 years' time, those libraries will still be around. I can't see any reason to hold that certainty. If you cast your mind back to 1650 and ask why did the things from 1650 survive until now, the answer is surely that they were preserved because they were the only medium in which that knowledge could be realistically preserved. We're no longer in that world where paper is the only medium to preserve knowledge, and those paying for preservation aren't necessarily going to want to preserve things that the people in this room, this special interest group, want preserved. If you are concerned with an economy and production, you may, as long as you can preserve the handbooks for Boeing jets, not need to preserve the Thackeray edition. And you may well choose to spend your money only preserving the electronic documents that you need to preserve. So I think the sense that paper will survive because libraries will endure, I think it's a short historical perspective. I think it's reading the last 10 to 15 years as though they're going to be the same as the next. And why? There doesn't seem to be any reason at all to assume that. I thought, can I connect that? Something that came up very early to do with the cost of things like EVO. The Joint Information Systems Committee in Britain, JISC, actually owns the data for the 18th century collections online, ECHO. And it has power to buy digital collections. It just simply bought the whole lot from Thomson. So when universities in Britain pay to get ECHO, they're just paying a sort of a small fee for the hosting that Thomson Gale does of data not owned by the publisher Thomson Gale. The complaints you made about these digital products being expensive in India are the same you'll hear in small universities in America, I think, because there's no national body. The core of this is the economics of the deals you can strike, and JISC can strike deals for the whole of the United Kingdom. And that's why British universities have Ebo, Echo, and Lion, because of JISC's power. That is kind of connected, actually, because I do see the national economics as being the key issue here to do with survival, not just of traditional literature, but actually of all the things we're concerned with, what we consider to be culture and conservative parts. A mechanism to address those things at a national level, I think, in terms of economics, before we can have the kind of certainties that we admit that we as a reflex have, which is that certain things will endure. I don't know that they...
Of course, are you implying that people will totally lose interest in Thackeray? Are you saying that they will access Thackeray in electronic edition, or they won't want to access Thackeray at all?
Certainly it's a danger that we will lose things we want to preserve in our knowledge of the economy that we have now, if we simply assume that the future is going to be rather like the past. And that things like libraries will endure. I don't know, as print, as places where all the books are kept, I don't know that libraries will survive in that way.
Actually, I think that is quite wrong. I do believe the libraries will be here 350 years from now, and unless there is some new technology that has not been invented yet that will actually preserve those things that we want preserved, what we want preserved is physical objects that are books. I mean, this is really a deep cultural desire. There are so many book collectors out there. There are so many. It's not just university libraries, and it is bookshops. And in fact, nobody actually is trying to eradicate the book. It's not that the book is difficult to eradicate. It's that nobody wants to do it, except you, who has no paper and makes a kind of religion out of not having any paper and perhaps not having any books and preferring it. But in fact, the smell of your computer is not attractive by comparison with the smell of my first editions. There's an awful lot of stuff that is simply not preserved electronically, and I grant I'm being a little bit facetious here, but the survival of the Thackeray edition in print, just to be specific, is not terribly important really to me. I don't think it ought to be printed on paper that lasts 350 years. I think it should be printed on newsprint, and that it should be distributed, therefore, cheaply, and that there should be 8,000 copies, not 180 copies, because the scholarship that goes into it, and all I have to do is look at the scholarship within my lifetime. I went to graduate school in the 1960s, and textual criticism was one of the central, important elements of my graduate education. And I have rejected nearly all of the principles that I was taught in graduate school. And when I look at the editions that were produced by, for example, the Center for Editions of American Authors, which was the be-all and end-all, Fredson Bauer saying, if we just do these editions right, they will never have to be done again. I mean, this all sounds rather quaint now. Of course they will have to be done again. Not because they were done wrong, but because we have started asking different questions. And in fact, all of those editions that were done under the auspices of the Center for Editions of American Authors, which all look extremely old-fashioned now, all continue to do what they set out to do. We just are interested in other things now. And so we need new editions to fulfill that, and I think that the electronic edition is probably going to be the best place eventually, but all I have to do is turn to Federico and ask, are we there yet? And he's shaking his head. No, we're not there yet. We don't have the means to produce an electronic edition that will do all of the things that we want done. And I don't mean just the heft, the texture, and the smell of paper editions. I mean guarantees of accuracy, of endurance, of maintenance, and those kinds of things, which in many ways take care of themselves in the book world. But I agree with you, they're probably going to be fewer and smaller libraries built, and maybe none. But I have a hard time believing that even in 350 years, barring global warming and huge disasters, that the existing libraries will be done away with simply because they're not needed anymore. That's just not going to happen.
No, their contents could quite plausibly be entirely digitized by their owners by then.
So they're digitized. That's just creating more. That's not replacing. Digitization never replaced anything.
Collindale Library.
A bunch of idiots.
Yes, they did it.
Yes, they did do it. That's true.
They destroyed the paper newspapers.
Yes.
And they made copies of them, I think, onto microfilm.
Do you think that was a good idea?
I can't answer that one, because what I wanted to get at was the economics, or whether or not I think it's a good idea. I just don't have the confidence that there is a long-term future for the media.
Right.
Coming back to the economic issue, I mean, what if, at the moment, GSK is happy to put lots of money into there? I don't know why they are thinking that it's viable business. But what if GSK decides that they don't want to put any money into that?
Yeah.
I mean, the book trade is kind of self-sustained, so you don't need huge amount of money in order to produce books.
Mm.
Whereas, in order to produce any electronic means, always the huge money is behind there to support your project already, hence, it's becoming viable. So, I mean, it looks to me that still electronic interfaces, electronic stuff is more expensive than the books to be produced, is it not?
We've been very pragmatic. We haven't been academics for all of this roundtable. We've been pragmatists. We've been talking about economics, like good 21st century scholars have to. But if we considered ourselves academics, let's consider the fact that we know that the amount of data capture, the amount of ingenuity which would go into an electronic digital edition on a hypertext basis is going to represent a reality of the production of text or text that we call King Lear or Hamlet or whatever, better than the print version, with its limitations that we really know are there, then perhaps we ought to be opinion formers and think about informing potential users so there is an audience out there for what we know at the end of the day will be nearer to our sense of the best academic value. Now, I'm being slightly devil's advocate about it, but I mean that there is an aspect in which it's a bit of a slip road to go down, talking about publishers and, it's reality, you know. But on the other hand, I'm just wondering whether we need to sell the virtues which I think in our various relative ways, we know that an electronically composed set of witnesses to intention and text will allow a reader to get hold of.
Can I say that, I mean, this is a problem, a more general problem, to do with English studies in general. What proportion of academics in English departments around the world are vitally interested at the moment in tracking down, in identifying variant readings between the versions of the works that they themselves are teaching tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And by and large, they're not. By and large, they set the textbook on the basis of its cost to their students. By and large, they set second-rate textbooks. That is second-rate from a textual studies point of view, so that they don't give their students the opportunity to study historically the life of particular work, if I can use that word. It's Ingarden's word from the 1930s, Husserl's too, I think. That opportunity to study the life of the work, to historicise the aesthetic, if you like, is just not normally available, and not enough, in my opinion, English literature academics, and indeed other literatures academics, are prepared to take the time to do that. And that helps explain Gabriel, your comment before of how few people, even in university English departments, know how to use textual apparatus.
Mm-hmm.
by and large, they find it too hard. Those that do actually persevere find that the work opens, that any particular work opens itself out into multiple histories in intriguing ways. That I think is one of the central points here. I mean, that's actually the activity that we're interested in as academics, isn't it? I mean, we're not interested fundamentally in whether the information is conveyed in a book or in electronic form. I mean, I think that's what this chapter, Stacey Kent's arguing, that it's a book culture we're interested in. The form of it is not vitally important. It's forms of understanding that are vitally important.
But actually, I think one needs to differentiate between a book culture and a textual culture. See, I mean, I think we're where we are here in the society where we come from. There's a vibrant book culture. People read books. In fact, they read books rather than, you know, access things by other, through the other media. But this is done, the whole, with very little awareness of the, you know, the textual history of the book that they are reading. See, the one doesn't, unfortunately, imply the other.
I take your point. I take your point, and I suppose it's really the textual culture
I stand corrected.
Yes. And that is the thing that is a problem more generally for English studies. Well, if it's true, as many people are saying, that the era of capital T literary theory is passing or has passed, then if you put that together with the rise of interest in book history, print culture, then there are clearly opportunities, you would hope, an interest and expectation that textual studies will once again have more to contribute to the normal literary critical engagements in the classroom. But to do that, we've got to get the student, the lecturers interested, and then the students interested. And well, it's pretty clear, wouldn't it be true of everyone around this table that you yourself, and much more so your students, are using electronic sources of information and find it utterly natural than going to the library? And so perhaps this is another possibility. The electronic scholarly edition will be the at least the naturalised first base if we want to inculcate and spread this textual culture.
Will it be any kind of scholarly edition? You see, I was thinking about this when Nigel was talking about the bookshops under control, which are flourishing with the coffee shops and everything, but those bookshops will never store a scholarly critical edition.
No.
See, and I think the gap that needs filling up is between the scholarly critical edition. I mean, there are probably the number of such critical editions that have been produced at the present day is greater than ever before. One way or the other, that have been produced over the last 50 years. But it has not filtered down to the crucial level, which is the kind of processed text on the basis of that edition, either for the student or for the general reader. See, and that is the biggest gap that needs to be bridged.
Well, I think, and I've said this many times, that textual scholarship has unearthed or revealed through its investigations some really fantastic bits of information that is completely hidden to most people who read one text and think that that one text represents the work. But then we have cleverly managed to take these revealing bits of difference and tension between texts and hidden them and coded them in such a way that it is too hard for people to focus on them. And then we have looked at those editions, particularly a lot of them that were done at the beginning of the 20th century by early scholars like George Saintsbury, who was a great promoter of, among other writers, Thackeray. And he does the Oxford Thackeray edition, and there are lists of variants at the back of the book. And, of course, they are only the major, not all of the minor revisions. And then I came along thinking, I have to do a new edition, and I looked, and of course my first job was to show that St. Spear had not done a good enough job, because his selection process was too something. Where in fact, probably, he's called attention to a great many of the most significant kinds of things for a reader, except that, of course, as soon as you say significant, significant divine, defined by whom and for what. So on the one hand, we have this tremendous need to do the whole project, to lay it all out. And then we have the fact that as readers, when I read Tom Jones by Fielding, for example, I don't want to see all of the versions. I'm very happy to see the difference between the first and the third and the fifth edition in the Man on the Hill episode, but I'm not sure that I want to have all of the variants that Bowers has listed on that one, because the good stuff that I'm interested in gets buried by all of the stuff, and yet if we don't do all of the stuff, how do we know what is the good stuff?
So you're saying that books put too many things, too much into one pot, because you get the
scholarly editions tend to do that. Yes,
we could separate those things out.
We could, and that's sort of. I'm glad you anticipated the point that I was aiming for, because I might have forgotten what it was if you hadn't pointed it out. And that is that, just as you said at the very beginning of this discussion, that there were certain kinds of works, mainly. I don't remember whether it was you or Paul who said the fragmented ones, mainly like dictionaries other kinds of reference books, where the access to them as print books is, well, it remains possible to buy them, bibliographies, and yet most of us would prefer to get them electronically, if for no other reason than we can search them in ways other than the alphabetical way that they are in print. And certainly when we read a long text that for which there are lots of variants, we might want to focus on some particular bits of it. We want a linear text for most of it, but we come to this one particular passage, we want to study that in depth. We want all the information at that point. And it could be that electronic access at that point would be better than print access, no matter how economic and beautifully designed the print apparatus was, so that we still want to read a text. And I've often thought of the electronic edition as sort of the motherlode. This is where the scholarship is taking place, and there should quite frequently be a print spin-off that does one thing or another from the motherlode beautifully for certain audiences.
Yeah.
Interesting, intellectual property law would tend to agree with you on that, in that distinction, because you wouldn't claim, once you've sorted out what Thackeray wrote, you wouldn't claim any ownership, really, over it. You'd claim the ownership on the process of determining what should be in the book.
If I wanted
So actually, that would coincide nicely with how intellectual property law would distinguish the various labours embodied in the critical edition. And if you separated them, you'd actually be clarifying the situation.
And if a purchaser of this spin-off, which is in print, had access to the electronic motherlode for answering questions like, well, where did this come from? Or what else is there at this point? Then we'd have the best of two worlds. We want the continued, that would be one way to say there's a continued role for the print edition.
Like say just a pair of things. First is that when Paul said that the scholar edition is two books in one, I think that instead we should say that a scholar edition is a book about a book. So it's a meta book. But there is a book about some other books, but this is a paradox in itself. Because with a book which has its own limits, which try to overcome the limits of the book. So that's and the second thing is that seems to be scholarly, electronic scholarly edition or printed scholarly edition. Why couldn't it be printed scholarly edition and electronic scholarly edition? It's and the logical operator, not or the other. Also because currently prints, every print form, 90% of their life is electronic. Only in the last step they became printed. I mean, all of you who works on a printed scholarly edition, you work on a Word file or a LaTeX file or anyway a computer file, and only in the end it becomes print. So what about an electronic edition which can generate also a print edition in whichever format you want, standard or a critical edition or a reading edition or a simple one version of a text without apparatus.
Print on demand kind of an edition.
Yeah, some kind of similar. Yeah. But some kind of framework is, so you can have the electronic edition with all the features with electronic and from this you can obtain also the print file which can be in a genetic edition, can be an authorial edition or simple reading text.
Well, there was a question there, why not? And the answer is that at the end of it, you're relying upon a market for printed books. And the logical conclusion, logical next step from what you're saying, is to acknowledge that it's very bizarre. We expect people to buy this stuff, any of it, since all the people who are academics around the table are paid by the state to do their work. Mm. It's remarkable that we're actually then also expecting there to be a commercial outlet for the same work. The people who paid for the research could rightly say, we've paid for the research, you can't give it to Macmillan or anybody else, it's ours. Now give it to the world, we've paid for it. And there's a very rational and compelling argument that we should just give our stuff away.
Yes. Now, this is only a minimal subset of what's happening in the university world. I mean, let's think about scientific university, all the big business of publishers like Elsevier or Kluwer, where they sell what the university produces. I mean, a scholarly edition are only a small subset of what's happening in...
We are giving our labour away, just about. I mean, the amount of the profit that's made out of whatever we do, I mean, it obviously it's bolstered by state, it's bolstered by taxes and so on, I know that. But in terms of real economic costing of what we do, we already do that. And if we were to cost the amount of labour, this is the trouble about applying for an external grant here, where we're simply going to come up with what real economic costing it is. I don't know any university in Britain who is actually going to cost, as it really does cost, the amount that it costs us to actually do the labour we do for, you know, the print editions. We get round it by saying it's a labour of love, it's what we're supposed to do, and all the rest. But in fact, in terms of its commercial, a lot of our work is subsidised, and I'm very glad for that. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, we can't charge what our labour is actually proved to be worth to Elsevier and others.
But I think the problem is that we give it.
We give it, yes.
To Elsevier. We don't give it to the public. We give it to somebody who then turns around and sells it.
Yeah.
And that's I think, what you were getting at. And I couldn't agree with you more. If there is some added value that is brought to the products of our scholarship by Elsevier, then I wouldn't feel so bad about it. But I don't see what the added value is, except perhaps distribution, which in fact you could do without them.
Could I make a comment here too? It sort of cuts across what the last few contributions, and it's got to do with this relationship between what you call it, the mother load, or in any case. I'm trying to imagine what that might
mothership.
Look like. But,
mothership.
Mothership, I think, might be better. In any case, let's think about it in terms of the full-scale critical edition or full-scale scholarly edition as opposed to a student edition or a general reader edition, where some of the information, some of the more interesting and fertile information that's likely to provoke thought, interest, commentary from readers, is provided about the different versions of the work. I think we do need to keep those two situations in mind, whether we're talking about print or whether we're talking about an electronic edition with a print-on-demand adaptation. So I think I've got two points about this. One is that the need for the scholarly edition in whatever form is always going to be there, if only for the reason that it's a systematic study of the history of a work. Now, the systematic nature of it occurs most vividly to the poor souls who have to do the texture, who are preparing the textual apparatus, because if it is not working systematically, your edition is in serious trouble. You can't just chop and change if you're being responsible about it. You can't just subjectively choose some variants because they happen to interest you, or amend other parts of the text because on the basis that your taste is far more interesting than the taste of your author from the 17th century. So it is a matter of creating a systematic study on the one hand, and then adapting it as editors in publishing houses have done for centuries to the needs of different categories of reader on the other. And to get back to your point, Federico, about why don't we just have an electronic edition, of which a printed scholarly edition is a sort of subset or download. I think we'd strike real problems there simply because the logic of the two media are different. And the logic of the two media finally have effects on the way you go about your business. In particular, the electronic files in a printed book are heading gradually towards files that are going to be used actually by the printing machine itself, which are not the same files as PDFs, which are not the same files as files that are coming immediately from the typesetting software, which in turn are not the same files as the editor, the scholarly editor, has probably been using Microsoft Word or some other software for. So you're heading towards a point of stabilization with print, whereas in the electronic edition, you're really heading towards availability and openness. You're not trying to close things down. You shouldn't be. So I think the logic of the two media is a problem, and it certainly struck me quite some years ago as we were trying to keep files in sync for these two purposes, for electronic editions of all of our Academy editions of Australian Literature. And in the end, there was just so much pressure during the proofing stages to get that single file, to keep your versions under control, and to get that single file, which is ultimately going to go to the printing machine, in a finalised form, that the time to keep all of the other, to keep your other versions continuous and precisely the same as the single file that's going forward, it just seems to break down. And so that at the end of the day, but actually at the end of the day, what I hope to do, I should say this, is that once I can get my publisher to agree, I hope to put all of those Academy editions up in PDFs available for free, because the logic of your case, I think, is just undeniable. But in the meantime, the publisher has got to get some kind of return for their own investment, and scholarly editions are expensive things to send to a printer.
Just on the technical side of that, I just wanted to remark that the Oxford Complete Thomas Middleton published next week. My understanding of the relationship between the editors and the press was that eventually it was decided that was too complicated, that the press would have to get camera-ready copy, which is why it has taken 20 years to produce the edition. Yeah. It's because a digital editor, John Levinino from King's, is producing camera-ready copy using his own software to do all the things you've described, because unless one person actually controls it all, it seems to be impossible for something as complicated as that multi-editor edition.
Yes, and that gets back to what I said about the logic of the two media. They have a different logic.
But is it really different, or is it just that we haven't seen
that way?
Because I know that there are probably in the case of Middleton as well, like there is a project of making the whole digital edition and the whole printed edition of the 17th century dramatists. And the James Sharia, and I asked the editor, so are these two projects are running together, and the same people are on board, but it looks like they are going to do the completely separate work because the logic is different. And it seems to be such a waste of labor and energy. I mean, there should be something which should be able to share. I can see your points that I mean, one is closed and one is open, but I don't know.
Yeah, but the issue is if the assumption is that one is closed and one is open, it's possible from the open
to close
it and produce it. I think yes.
Yeah.
And I think at least of two or three projects, I can quote my mind, that they starting from the electronic edition to produce printed one, like the which are using, I mean, technology which are suitable. Because for electronic edition, what do we mean? We mean an edition which goes on CD-ROM, like was in the 80s. We mean an edition which was which went on the internet, like is now. It's, electronic edition is not a monolithic sentence, like it's not textual criticism. It's not a monolithic sentence. And there's one project on Ibsen, which so they use web-oriented technology to produce printed edition. Also, the Wittgenstein project in Bergen, they use internet-oriented technology. So I think that it has not been studied enough, but I think that it's possible to consider the printed edition as a subset of the electronic of electronic framework.
That was things with what you were saying.
Mm-hmm. I certainly hope so. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Maybe through your work. One of the things we were going to sort of go up, we haven't got time to talk about. What are the insights from textual criticism that would be applicable in pedagogics? And we've been skirting that issue. We've been talking about different kind of logics, different kind of readers and so on. And I think one of the more general reflections, which I think has struck a chord with the students I've taught, is how much of their experience is already edited, is already pre-chosen.
Yes.
Here's a chance with a scholarly hypertext edition, should we say, when they can, just for a while, make of it what their initiative will allow them to. In a strange sort of way, it joins hands in this unholy alliance with, say, deconstruction. Derrida, right? Who preaches, to an extreme, perhaps, the idea that, you know, we're captive to words, and words can be turned inside out. As an editor, we're really preaching the same sort of thing, that if you're captive to just one edition, you're being unnecessarily captive to a moment, right? And it seems to me we can operate on the student sensibilities, a different kind of logic we've heard tell, then maybe there would be a more of a market out there, more of a receptive, we could prove there's more of a market out there for the kind of more deluxe offerings we're after.
Maybe over the next, 20 years, as the infrastructure for electronic editions gets integrated with the infrastructure for electronic production of criticism and histories and biographies and all the other things that are related to our study of Shakespeare or our study of Emily Dickinson, such that in what I would like to call a knowledge site, there is a repository of electronic representations of text in both image and transcription, that there is textual information, that there are places where people have put their decisions about what the text ought to be, even if it's only a 40-60 decision, where the historical annotations, where the critical insights, where the essays are all created, distributed, published, shall we say, electronically instead of in the book world, where the refereeing systems that now exist for the book world will actually be operating in the electronic world properly, where the distribution system exists, where somehow the greedy, as it seems to me, controllers of knowledge have put economic barriers in the way, have been somehow or another defeated or skirted, such that Echo and Ebo are not available just to British students, but are also available to all Indian students. That's where I think we might eventually go. I don't think we're very close, and I think that we're in a kind of a guerrilla warfare point right now, economically. But if we look to what it is that we really are doing, and why we are doing it, and for whom we are doing it, and what it is that they are doing that we need to be interested in too. I think it's going to work itself out into an electronic community, which previously for 500 years we've been developing as a print community.
You anticipated in that wish, well, I've heard some vows. I have the hopes, he says, that electronic computers can be put to work to digest and to analyse much information that at present we do not have. It will be a blessed day in the future when one can press a button and give such a lordly command as list for me every time compositor B followed his copy in spelling win as W-I-N or W-I-N-N-E, every time he changes a copy spelling from one to the other, and distinguish those cases when he does it in prose or verse, and given all the occasions he does it when set from manuscript. And that's Hudson Bowers, 1965. Hoping that shortly that would be possible. It's extraordinary that nothing like that has been achieved in 42 years.
Probably because it's not been considered the real core. I mean, this is the whole vision of how the computer should help textual criticism as an autistic worker. And now the situation is changing. The computer is not only an autistic worker, it's a medium, with all what is implied, changing the whole process of textual criticism, and in particular how the text is encoded and how the text is published, so the two extremes of the...
There are some things the computer will do when you push a button. Crash. Maybe not those particular things. Yeah, crash. I think our time is almost up, and it seems to me we have reached a kind of... mutual understanding of the questions that we started with. Whether we have any agreement about any of the answers is another question. I just want to thank everyone for having come.